Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wasn't it supposed to be over by now? The subprime mess and the credit crunch, I mean? That's what everybody was saying last summer when all the bad news started. But even after the Bear Stearns bailout and the rescue plan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Wall Street is still in trouble. Today, it's Lehman Brothers, which is looking at a fire sale to stay alive. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 19th of August today. You know, Wall Street is a pretty insular place, one where everybody knows everybody else's business, and they keep track of how everybody's business is doing, too. According to J.P. Morgan, Lehman Brothers ain't doing too hot. Morgan's analysts said today they figure Lehman's going to have to write off another $4 billion worth of subprime debt gone bad. If that's not enough to make you wonder how long the subprime mess is going to keep on playing out, there are reports today that Lehman's shopping around some of its most lucrative operations as a way to raise cash. What it all adds up to is speculation that yet another Wall Street bank is on the verge of going under. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Lehman Brothers is holding a giant fire sale. The investment bank's critics say it won't get much now for stinky subprime mortgages. They're trading at deep discounts. Walter Gerasimovich is CEO of Metatron Asset Management.
They took on far too much risk. They lost sight of their risk management from years ago.
Lehman's not commenting on reports that it might sell part of its asset management division, which handles rich people's money. Gerasimovich says eventually Lehman will be taken over by a stronger company. He compares Lehman to a wounded patient who's fading fast.
The bleeding needs to be stemmed, and they need the transfusion from a larger partner, because they will not be able to survive financially on their own.
But there's another view.
First I was afraid, I was petrified.
Some analysts say Lehman will soon be grooving to a different tune.
I will survive.
Scott Sprinzen follows Lehman for Standard & Poor's.
Now, we don't feel that they face any insurmountable challenges or crisis.
Sprinzen says Lehman has plenty of cash on hand. The problem, he says, market psychology.
They have to react to the market perceptions, even if they're not well grounded in fundamentals.
Sprinzen says Lehman is reacting by getting rid of those problem mortgages. But Metatron's Gerasimovich says investors are worried that Lehman could be a lost cause and that negative psychology could be enough to tip the investment bank over the edge. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The housing industry and those problem mortgages that Nancy mentioned are at the root of the credit squeeze, of course. And just like Wall Street, troubles in the housing industry aren't going away as quickly as anybody had hoped. We learned this morning housing starts hit a 17-year low in July. If they're not selling, nobody's going to build them, right? At the same time, prices at the wholesale level bounced up to a 27-year high. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more now on the economic indicator du jour and where things go from here.
Producer prices jumped 1.2% last month, much more than expected. Even when you take out energy and food swings, core inflation rose 0.7%. That means high energy prices are rippling through the whole economy. One big reason, producers are passing along their higher costs of supplies. But remember, these are July numbers, and prices for raw materials, from aluminum to fertilizer to petroleum, have dropped as much as 20% since. Many economists, including Gary Schilling, figure July will likely be the worst of the inflation.
Because commodity prices are starting to crumble. So I think that by the end of the year, I'd be bold enough to say the Federal Reserve will be back worrying about deflation as opposed to inflation.
On the other hand, we don't know how long this good news on commodity prices is going to last.
That's Ira Kamenow, a former vice president of the Philadelphia Fed. He says Fed members are counting on the slowing economy to take the edge off inflation. But if the Fed waits too long, he says there's a risk.
Once workers and businesses begin to think that inflation is flaring up again, they're going to want to begin pushing up their prices and wages so they don't get killed by rising wages and prices from their suppliers. Then you can start getting a very serious wage price spiral.
If core inflation doesn't drop substantially soon, Kamenow figures the Fed will begin raising interest rates before the year is out. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Europeans have their own economic problems. All 15 countries that use the euro saw their economy shrink last quarter. But there is arguably a more imminent threat that they have to deal with, which explains why it was all Russia all the time in Brussels today. NATO foreign ministers were meeting to try to figure out what they can do about Moscow and its invasion of Georgia. Not much, as it happens, because the Allies have made it clear they don't want a military confrontation with Russia right in its own backyard. So the focus is shifting to the European Union and whether it can use economic power to persuade the Russians to pull out. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
The EU should have more leverage with Russia than anyone else. Right on its doorstep, the bloc is by far Russia's biggest trading partner. The EU brokered a peace deal over the Georgia conflict, and Russia clearly breached it. But Nicholas Redman of the Economist Intelligence Unit says don't expect any punitive action from the EU.
The bottom line is that the EU is divided, and until Russia ups the ante so dramatically that even those countries that are basically well disposed towards Russia are willing to take a firmer line, you're not going to see a firmer line.
And certainly not from Germany. The EU's economic superpower depends on Russia for almost 50% of its natural gas. Germany is unlikely to call for trade sanctions against Moscow. The EU could oppose Russian membership of the World Trade Organization. It could call for Russia to be booted out of the G8. But, says Tomasz Velasek of the Center for European Reform, none of this would cut much ice with the Russians.
The reality is Russia wants to trade with the European Union. It wants to be liked and respected by the European Union. But there's really no particular threat that you can level against Russia to threaten Russia into withdrawing from Georgia.
He says that Europe needs Russia more than the Russians need Europe. That will only change if the Europeans can wean themselves off their dependency on Russian energy. They are trying, but it will take time. The fate of Georgia may well be decided long before the Europeans find enough alternative supplies of gas and oil. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Take the inflation report, add rising oil and a sprinkling of credit squeeze, and it's a down day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We don't read too many medical journals around here, but an item in one of them caught our eye today. There's a report in the current edition of the Annals of Internal Medicine about Merck and its discredited painkiller, Vioxx. By a way of refresher here for a second, Merck pulled Vioxx off the market almost 4 years ago after it was linked to a series of fatal heart attacks. Today's report is about a 1999 study that Merck did to test the side effects of Vioxx. It shows that that study, the 1999 one, was actually what's known in the pharmaceutical business as a seed study, research used primarily for marketing, a way for Merck to get its drug into as many doctors' hands as it could. Dr. Ross McKinney runs the Center for Bioethics at the Duke University Medical School. Dr. McKinney, good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
How widespread is this practice of these seed studies?
Seeding studies are, we believe, quite common practice. There's not good documentation, but they've been recognized since the early 90s to be a common means for the pharmaceutical industry to get practitioners to use new drugs.
If they don't do them, do pharmaceutical companies risk leaving money on the table?
Oh, I don't think so. I think these are something that's really, there are lots of marketing strategies available without having to do these sort of seeding studies.
So why do them then? I mean, obviously it brings up the question of transparency and some ethical concerns.
Well, if they're done correctly, they actually get valuable information. So say, for example, the study that in fact was cited, their trial was good enough that it was able to be published in the Annals of Internal Medicine back in 2003. It was a real study. You can say the intent wasn't good, that it was marketing, but in fact they learned important information about their drug. My bias is that if it's a good scientific study, it's probably not totally unethical to do a seeding study.
Is there a rule, though, from the FDA or anybody else that says companies have to reveal their true motives in conducting these studies?
There is not a rule that says they have to reveal their true motives. And in fact, the reality is that every drug company study is ultimately intended to get more widespread use of their drug. So the seeding studies are done as marketing, but all drug company studies are really done to advance the sales of their products.
Why does this news today, then, leave us saying, ew, somehow?
Because the intent was so clearly focused on marketing in this, and actually this is really just an indicator that tells us that there's a problem, because seeding studies are the kind of studies that are going to get people who would otherwise participate in research, volunteer to help us with clinical trials to advance knowledge. Those people may not want to participate because they'll be suspecting the motives of the pharmaceutical industry sponsorship.
What's the FDA's role in this? Do they have a job here to police these kinds of seeding studies?
The FDA should be policing seeding studies, but in fact, they don't have jurisdiction if the drug is already licensed. So the FDA only has a role if it's a drug that's not yet approved, or the information is going to be submitted to the FDA for changing the indications of the drug.
So if Merck had wanted to, they could have kept this whole thing under wraps and we'd have never known about it.
Exactly. And that's a real problem, because all these people would have been put at risk and nobody would ever be the wiser.
Expand on the risk factor here for these participants in the clinical trial for a second. They were given medications which later has been shown to be not entirely beneficial, and which in fact Merck is going to pay out $4.5 billion to settle claims over.
Exactly. So even though this was also
that Merck could get marketing data.
The fact that Merck did this study was, at the time, they thought they were getting people to use what was a real advance. And had it been that there was no cardiac toxicity, it would have been a therapeutic advance. And it's through studies that you learn about these toxicities. But there's always a risk whenever you do any kind of investigation of a new pharmacologic agent.
Dr. Ross McKinney is the director of the Trent Bioethics Center at Duke University. Dr. McKinney, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Guy.
I wasn't the best high school student ever. Skated by with B's. B-minuses, really, if you ask my mother. Got through the SATs with not a whole lot of room to spare, which is why this next story caught my eye. There's a new standardized test in the works. Call it a pre-college entrance exam for eighth graders. It's in development at the College Board, the nice people who already bring us the SAT and the PSAT. With high schoolers already up to their eyeballs in number two pencils and little bubbles, the industry is looking to put the middle school market to the test. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
You might think a preteen staring down another standardized test would howl in protest. Not necessarily so.
I'd like it so you could learn about it, you know, and know what's coming up, because it's a pretty hard test.
Seventh grader Brendan Hartnett of West Omaha, Nebraska. He says the pre-SAT might help him crack the code of the all-powerful college entrance exam. A lot of middle school kids might disagree. Just ask their parents.
And if I would have told my eighth grader that she would have to take the PSAT exam, I don't think she'd be talking to me anymore. These kids are under a lot of pressure as it is, and, you know, adding college-related pressure to an eighth grader, at least as a parent, I think might be a little bit too much.
That's Jeff Silber talking like a dad. But as an education analyst for BMO Capital Markets, Silber says this new SAT will be a moneymaker for the College Board.
That means more test prep and more, you know, assessment-related services after the fact in terms of the people that, you know, score the test, etc.
This new test isn't just about competition between students, but between testing companies. Paul Kanarex with the Princeton Review, one of the largest test prep companies in the country. He says after two decades of dominance, the SAT has been losing ground to the ACT, a fundamentally different test.
The SAT tends to be a test of how well you take exams. The ACT tends to be a test of how well you know your curriculum.
Princeton Review has seen double to triple digit growth in its ACT courses this year. The ACT already offers a pretest for eighth graders. And if a school system starts with one test, it's more inclined to stay with it. So the new test would put the SAT on equal footing with its rival. The College Board wouldn't talk about the new test or when it may be available. Critics say another test will only squander state education budgets. Robert Schaefer is with Fair Test, a watchdog group. He says we already spend nearly $1 billion a year on testing and test prep, and the cost of the PSAT is subsidized in many school districts.
Starting the college admissions testing arms race even earlier ends up increasing costs for parents and taking money away from education. It's a marketing move, not an educational one.
But the test could help identify promising minority and at-risk students and direct them to advanced placement classes before they find themselves in woodshop. Ann Garber's an educational consultant in Los Angeles. She's also on the board of the nonprofit College Grad LA.
In some cases, this could really be opening up a whole new door for students perhaps whose parents have never gone to college, and it's just not really on their radar.
The Los Angeles School District has reportedly committed more than $100,000 so that every eighth grader can take the test when it becomes available in a year or two. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, scrappy authors take on the book publishing empire.
We're here representing Star Wars, and I, of course, am Master Obi-Wan, and this is Master Yoda.
Well, how come you got the short straw and had to hold Yoda all afternoon?
Well, he's an awful lot shorter.
And he is an awful lot stronger.
But first, let's do the numbers. Credit worries and higher inflation hit the markets today. The Dow Industrial shed 130 points, 1.1% to finish at 11,348. The Nasdaq lost 32 points, 1.3% to end at 2384. The S&P 500 watched 11 points evaporate. That's a touch under 1% to close at 1266. We told you all about that multi-billion dollar hit that J.P. Morgan thinks Lehman Brothers is going to take, right? Well, investors reacted by kicking away more than 13% of Lehman's stock value. Bank of America gave back more than 4% today. Wells Fargo coughed up 3.5%. Those nasty July housing start numbers hammered home builders. Lennar deconstructed nearly 5%. Pulte Homes sawed off 3.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Clinton Global Initiative, convening world leaders from government, industry, and NGOs to commit to action on global challenges. ClintonGlobalInitiative.org.
Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Orlando, President Bush is scheduled to address the veterans of foreign wars during their annual convention. On August 20, 1975, NASA launched Viking 1. The spacecraft was the first to land successfully on Mars. And musician Robert Plant has a birthday. The former Led Zeppelin vocalist will be 60. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. PPI is the shorthand for the economic number of the day, producer price index. Figures like that one tell us a lot about the state of the economy. It goes hand in hand with monthly statistics on retail sales and manufacturing. And the big one that people have been watching lately, unemployment. Commentator Megan Husted says economic numbers are important, but so are the words that go with them.
A friend of mine told me last week that he decided to leave his boring desk job behind and go freelance. But this venture into self-employment wasn't entirely his idea. Truth is, he'd been fired. The anecdotal evidence is mounting. Severance packages are being negotiated that allow the injured party to claim publicly that they're leaving of their own free will. The temptations of striking this deal are obvious. Say you've gone freelance and you escape the embarrassment of the pink slip. You also sound proactive. You're no victim of tough economic times. You've simply made an alternative lifestyle choice. When the book Free Agent Nation came out in May 2001, the W-2lists were hailed as everyday heroes who'd thumbed their noses at regular paychecks and dove into the exhilarating waters of self-determination and 1099s. This rosy vision was always too gleeful for my tastes. I'm self-employed, and I can testify that doing double duty as my own IT help desk hardly makes for a carnival atmosphere. So I'm hopeful that this conflating of freelance with "you've been fired" will put an end to romantic free agent rhetoric. It seems to be already. Picture this. I go to a cocktail party and tell people that I'm a writer. They're usually impressed, but tell them I'm a freelance writer, and they reflexively take two steps backwards, as if to escape the aura of failure. But whether this trend presents more substantive problems remains to be seen. Sure, Orwell would quibble with the language, but could claiming full responsibility for your own joblessness be a force for good? Could it bolster your sense of being the captain of your soul? Or would Kubler-Ross merely recognize it as stage one, denial? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, payroll employment decreased by 51,000 this July. Call me old-fashioned, but I prefer that people felt comfortable saying, "I was fired." After all, these days, no job? You're in good company.
Megan Husted is the author of the book, How to Be Useful. She lives in New York City. Let us hear from you about what you hear on the program. Go to marketplace.org and then click on that link that says contact. Several of you did that yesterday to point out a mistake in our commentary on the link between politics and lobbying. We said Condoleezza Rice was on the board of Exxon before joining the Bush administration. In reality, it was Chevron. Got a stack of books still left to get through this summer, you'd better get cracking. There's not even 2 weeks left until summertime is over, and with it, the summer reading season. Sorry as you might be to hear that, publishers are probably more so. Profits are down because they say nobody reads anymore. But maybe that's because we don't like the selection of books out there. Cash Peters went to the industry's big trade fair earlier this summer, Book Expo, and he found people who think they could do a better job picking winners than the big publishing houses.
Now, call me crazy, but I thought the book industry was doomed. But then along came this new thing called print on demand. David Taylor is the head sales guy for a company called Lightning Source, which does just that.
The fundamental thing this does is it means that publishers don't have to guess anymore how many books to print and print them speculatively. What they do is they get the order first and then they print it.
Wow, that's revolutionary. And it means, thanks to new technology, the playing field has been levelled suddenly. It's no longer just the big boys putting out books nobody in their right minds would ever want to read. Now anyone can.
Yes, there will always be rubbish published. You know, some of the best-known names in publishing have foisted on the world some of the worst content ever.
I would say anything by Tolkien, personally, but that's just my...
by Tolkien, absolutely.
That guy will never make a penny.
But it's, you know, it's enabling publishers to completely re-engineer their business.
I know, it's genius. In the old days, authors faced constant rejection from major publishers. Example, I had a great idea for a kid's book. During the book expo, I pitched it to a woman at Penguin Books.
It's called Trevor the Travel Iron.
The Travel Iron?
Yeah, yeah. Right? And it's like a travel book for kids.
Interesting.
And it's like full of lots of adventure.
No.
But meanwhile, he's always ironing.
Well, first of all, kids will not know what a travel iron is. Where do you stay that doesn't have an iron? What kind of places are you staying in?
See, she just picked holes in it. But now the rules are changing. Now anyone with a great idea like that can just go ahead and publish it themselves really cheaply. Take David Ash of Basho Books. Basho Books being David Ash.
So what kind of books do you sell?
Humorous haiku gift books. Haiku is a three-line, 17-syllable poem that the Japanese invented about 400 years ago. And I can tell you quite distinctively that no one has ever considered doing a series of haiku gift books before. But who knows? It might work.
Right.
You don't remain convinced, but that's okay.
Of course, it's not enough to just print books. You also have to, A, get them into stores, which can be a real headache for small publishers.
I know how to make a book and print 1,500 of them and get them into my basement. It's getting them out of my basement before my wife divorces me that is the key.
Or getting book buyers into your basement to buy them.
Yes, that would be fine too.
Oh, I have such great ideas. Also, and this is B, whether you're a big or small publisher, your book still has to have some gimmick or angle to attract customers.
We're here representing Star Wars, and I, of course, am Master Obi-Wan, and this is Master Yoda.
How come you got the short straw and had to hold Yoda all afternoon?
Well, he's an awful lot shorter.
And he is an awful lot stronger.
No, he an awful lot stronger is.
Too true. Impressed I am with you.
What are you giving out?
Time flies when you're in a coma. The wisdom of the metal gods.
Time flies when you're in a coma.
Yes, it's a compilation of affirmations, meditations, and mantras.
It's a self-help book for people
right.
in a coma.
Yeah.
Who are you?
I'm Marley the monkey.
Marley the monkey.
I teach youngsters how to share.
How many hours a day do you spend in this costume?
Right now, about four.
And are you really tired of doing this?
Do I really sound that bored? I'm excited. I'm promoting a book about monkeys and sharing.
And who can say no to that? Oddly, the feeling you get from the show is one of optimism and excitement, almost as though books won't be crushed by the onslaught of technology after all, like we were expecting. Lance Fensterman is a big cheese at the Book Expo.
The perfect piece of technology has already been invented, and it is the book.
So will there be a Book Expo 2030?
It will be a floating book expo. We'll all be wearing jetpacks, and the Martians will be amongst us.
So that's a no, then. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters, author of the Trevor the Travel Lion books for kids.
Trevor the Travel Lion goes to Peru. And then the subtitle is...
But if you're going to Peru, are you really worrying about ironing your clothes?
Some people have no vision. Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today on a topic that might be near and dear to many of you, our cell phones. How much we don't like the ones we have and how much we're willing to spend on new ones. The research firm NPD Group said today we're collectively buying fewer new cell phones, down 13% from a year ago. But we're spending an average of $84 on the ones that we do buy. That's up 14% over the same period, though you can't really tell from the data whether that includes all the crazy rebates and incentives that phone companies pile on there to get you to buy one in the first place. In all, we bought $2.4 billion worth of new mobiles last year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 130 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ shed 32 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 slipped 11 points. That is just under 1% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on the program, the downsides of apartment dwelling. That would be noisy kids.
Our neighbor just finally had the epiphany that you can't wrap them in bubble wrap at the end of the day, and there is no off switch.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that one tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.